into Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1 FM in the East Bay, and you're listening to Radio Autonomía, Autonomy Radio, a Zapatismo in the Bay. And we just heard Prisons on Fire, produced by Freedom Archives and Prison Radio Project. And we're going into another segment where we're looking at prisons and in their effects in our communities. And in various spaces and projects this past month, we have heard from critical conversations around prisons and the prison industrial complex and stories of community resiliency and community regeneration. From Critical Resistance, April issue of the Abolitionists focusing on mental health and resiliency, to the recent publication and book tour conversation of Maroon the Implacable, the collected writings of Russell Maroon Schultz. We have heard questions posed and strategies shared around what it takes for individuals and communities to stay resilient, connected, and strong in the midst of the prison industrial complex. We have also heard analysis of the various ways the prison and the prison industrial complex enacts violence on communities of color and lower income communities. We found these conversations timely given the recent increased presence and popularity of zero tolerance, lifestyle quality policing, suppression style policing in and within Oakland. This style of policing has been articulated through the gang injunctions of 2011 and the hiring of William Brenton and Bob Wasserman, and the increased presence of ICE, immigration, customs enforcement, and raids within many Oakland communities.
So in that sense, we wanted to bring you all together, and thank you, Manuel and Anita, for coming into the studio today. We wanted to continue these critical conversations on the radio so it maybe gets out to more folks, and just to keep these types of conversations going. And in this conversation, we also wanted to name the symbolic and physical violence that the prison industrial complex bring to communities of color and lower-income communities in the Bay Area. And we wanted to kind of frame it a little bit and talk more about what strategies and projects and spaces, communities that you all are part of or maybe involved in, are using to build resiliency and regenerate the community violence. So first off, we just wanted to have you all introduce yourselves on the show, and then talk a little bit about what projects y'all are currently working on, or working within, and the different movements you're a part of.
My name is Anita Wills, and I'm an activist in the community. I've worked with the Oscar Grant Committee in the past. I'm a member of All of Us and None. I'm a member of Occupy for Prisoners. And we're working on a People's Community Database project right now. Another project that I'm working on is very important to me is to request that the Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, and the Attorney General of California, Kamala Harris, investigate the wrongful conviction of my son, who is in prison in the California state prison system. So I have a petition that is going around, but those are the projects that I'm working on right now.
My name is Manuel LaFontaine, and I am a father, an uncle, a son, and a formerly incarcerated person. Most important, I'm a human being, and I need to emphasize that, because the minute anyone here in America is convicted of a crime and sentenced, we are then labeled all these subhuman characteristics that allows the state and multinational corporations to attack us through their media, CBS, NBC, Fox, and whatnot. So I think it's important for many of us who have been incarcerated come out the closet, if we haven't already, and speak to the violence that's being used through the language. And I'm also a proud member of All of Us and None, and we're focusing on many different campaigns. One of the most important ones is trying to bring to light and amplify the voices of people right now being held in solitary confinement in what many of us could have called, you know, prisons within prisons, control units, control dungeons, and their plight to be looked as human beings and not be labeled and treated as the worst of the worst here in America, particularly in California.
Great. So we wanted to start off the conversation talking about the specific effects. So a lot of us think of, when we think of prisons, we think of them as isolated places, not only geographically, but also in the sense of who's part, who's related to them, right? So we wanted to talk more specifically about what effects does the prison, the symbolic, the physical prison, but also the symbolic prison have on the communities here, right? And some of us have named the prison industrial complex or low intensity warfare and how that plays out, but we were just wanting to see, begin the conversation of what effects do you all think that has, both physical and then also symbolic.
It's important, I think, to first recognize that we cannot talk about violence in America without talking about the social, economic, and environmental violence that's being put out by the institutions here in America. And we, as people of color, have been conditioned to see violence through the eyes of the oppressor. And to make it clear who the oppressor is, it's the state, the multinational corporations, the military, and all those institutions that allow the status quo to continue, where capitalism stays, thrives, stays alive. And many of us, of course, are trying to fight against that, because when we're conditioned, then we sometimes can only see the violence through our own behavior, as opposed to looking at the state and the institutions that are promoting violence, that make and produce violent human beings. So I think we have to go from that underlying premise, because if not, then we start looking at the individual or individuals as opposed to looking at the systems. And I have to go back to that, because I could assume responsibility for my actions, still don't negate so many the lives of so many people, particularly women and children, who are being incarcerated through these through these practices that then put the blame on the individual.
I want to go back to after the Civil War, when they were setting up camps for the newly freed slaves. And they called them work camps, but they were putting them in these camps, which were nothing but prisons, and forcing them to labor, to work for free. The same thing that they had been doing in, you know, before slavery ended. This was mostly in the South. The reason I want to go back to that and come back to today, what is going on today, which is touching my life and affecting my life, is that my son was a carpenter. He was a journey level carpenter. He's a journey level machinist. He worked all of his, you know, his adult life, and made good money. Today he's working and he's making maybe 25 cents an hour for the prison industrial complex. And when I say wrongful conviction, he's not the only one that's in prison wrongfully convicted. He's not the only one who refused to cooperate with the district attorney and take a plea, you know, and then have the district attorney come back and maliciously prosecute him because he refused to just say that he committed a crime that he said he did not commit. He's an African-American male. He was 31 years old at the time. And what they used to convict him, you know, he was supposed to be on trial for second-degree murder, but there was no evidence that he ever committed that crime. So they convicted him for being a drug dealer. They convicted him for being a gang member. And they talked that up to the white jury, all white jury, who already sees our young men as drug dealers and gang members. So that's the way they spent the trial. And that's what he was convicted for. Because the DA, nor the Oakland Police Department, had any information that my son actually committed the crime that he was accused of. But the point was to get him in jail, to use him as an example, to have the Oakland Tribune running articles calling him names, you know, calling him a drug dealer, calling him a felon, and calling him all these different names along with the court system, you know. And during this time, the mayor of Oakland was Jerry Brown. This was in 2001. He was the mayor of Oakland, and he was, you know, tough on crime because he was going to eventually run for governor. But I'm saying that to make the connection between the politicians, the courts. The courts were willing to overlook the fact that there was no evidence and allow the trial to proceed. the DA was allowed to do whatever was necessary to get this this man tried on three strikes. They did not look at the family, the fact that he is a father, and 60% of my grandchildren's income ended when my son was arrested. You know, that affected them greatly. Their father has been out of their lives. One of them was murdered. You know, he's dead. He's 19 years old. This is how it affects my life. But I see that in the community where these men are taken out and taken away and put in prison for, you know, for little or nothing and given a lot of time. And a lot of these men are taking pleas. They're just saying, okay, I'll take the plea. And they don't understand that that's going to stay on their records and follow them. You know, it's like almost like a death sentence. You know, they won't be able to find employment. They won't be able to get an education. They won't be able to live, you know, have families. So it's a whole, you know, like it's the prison industrial complex is not just about being arrested and going to prison. It's so much more than that. And the last thing I want to mention is that there are private prisons, and Jerry Brown is talking about, you know, keeping these men in prison, in these private prisons, you know, because they're being regulated by the feds. And they're selling on Wall Street. And Wells Fargo is one of the banks who has stockholders who own stocks in the private prison system. So this country is run on the, you know, on the exploitation of cheap labor. And the prison industrial complex is part of that. It's part of this whole crazy, you know, capitalist system. So that's all I have to say.
So, kind of in response to thinking through or the ways that the prison and the prison industrial complex has affected our communities, what kind of community regeneration process or practices and projects do you know of or are you part of that are responding to these effects or responding to the prison industrial complex?
Before I go into providing some solution, I wanted to go back and just state that I know that many of us get caught up in using terms and slogans that we understand well. We as activists, revolutionary thinkers, critical thinkers, like slogans like end mass incarceration, you know, prison industrial complex, and we recognize why we use that. And at the same time, we have to recognize the state learns how to simplify language that then we can adopt and co-opt and then throw back, and our own family members will use that to keep us confused. And what I mean by that, for example, is, and I think I'm going to read something that Russell Maroon Schultz has written in the book, Maroon the Implacable. He says, we are involved in a cultural war, which has many fronts, political, economic, social, moral, and ethical. They call it a war on poverty, quote, a war on crime, a quote, unquote, war on drugs, or a war on childhood disease, unquote. And tomorrow they will make up another deceptive title to maneuver behind. You know, however, it's the idea of behaviors, institutions of America in their many forms that are being fought over. If you do not recognize this fact, then your soul will be stolen by your enemy, by our enemy, and used to fuel the machine. He goes on to say they are death dealers and death merchants, and they destroy anyone that threatens to slow down or expose their mindless accumulation of wealth, power, and control. It makes no difference whether you are the innocent, the young, or the elderly. If you cannot add to the accumulation of power, they will grind you to dust. Still more, they will vilify, mock, and otherwise distort you, who you are, to the end of getting everyone on their side. So it's going back that we as critical thinkers have to create language that and terminologies that will be accessible to our own mothers, to our own theos and grandfathers, that sometimes we may disregard and dismiss them as saying, well, you know, we can't change them. But I find that really hard to believe when I'm challenging everyone around me, and now they're starting to look at incarceration at a different way. And so that goes back to one way is that when we're having this conversation, we come home from a long day of activism, from march or from work, that we can have conversations with our own family members and try to be patient, trying to allow them to see that our critical thinking has taken years in many ways. For me, it took so many years inside a cage, which takes us back to these control units I want to briefly talk about. So these control units here in America are the best practice being used by imperialism, by governments that want to create such a capitalistic mindset and therefore allow their tentacles to spread elsewhere and keep those who are standing up against them quiet. And these control units have been spreading out throughout America. In California, we call them security housing units. And to all our viewers, audience, listeners, imagine being held in a space as big as your bathroom, the smallest bathroom or the smallest room in your house. And it's about 10 by 6 with no human contact, with no sunlight available, with no human interaction for a month, for 6 months, for 5 years, for 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years. That's just an imagination. This is the reality, the truth for so many people right now in California and throughout America. I mean, you can go internationally, throughout Guantanamo Grave, throughout Abu Ghraib, and all these places that the United States has its tentacles at. So many folks are rising up, and a couple years ago, on July of 2011, folks decided to go on hunger strike. So many folks may ask, why go on a hunger strike when that is self-destructive? Well, when you have no other method to employ to allow folks to hear your cry, the cry of being tortured, being held indefinitely, then you sometimes have to use your body as the last resort to then get people to hear you and see if they can support you. And I think Maroon, again, briefly, I'm going to touch back on something that he says that is important. He says, this is page 25 of his book, Maroon the Implacable. As a warden of the first U.S. prison control unit set up by the government of Maryland, Illinois, stated in the open court, quote, control units are designed to control and suppress revolutionary tendencies in the country. And for those who are not familiar with what control units are, just let me say that they are prisons within prisons, an archipelago from one end of the United States to the other. These torture camps have been condemned by the United Nations representative on torture, but remain in place because they are said to hold the worst of the worst. He goes on to say, shortly, the technicians, quote-unquote, who run these places have developed, quote-unquote, clean torture techniques that are primarily designed to break your mind, to break your will to resist, to co-opt you as a willing pawn in their war to pacify and exploit you for the service of capital. They're designed to keep you controlled by your entire sentence until you are dead. So that's one of our campaigns, is to raise these voices that are coming from, for example, Russell Maroon Schultz. He's been down over 40 years in another prison outside of California that many people within the state of California can identify within the conditions he's describing. So it's important for us as next steps to figure out how can we become more aware of what's going on to people inside these control units. And I'm part of a coalition called the Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity Coalition. And if you were to put this Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity just on Google, you'll be able to find our website. And there's many ways that people can support. And after others here can speak to, I can also provide more specific ways.
Just one thing that you mentioned, and I think we could have a little bit longer conversation about, is that how the control units are set up to actually control revolutionary thought, right? So when people think of the SHU or control units, they think of, like, you know, that prison inside the prison where, like, people for some reason can't hang in the general population, so they're forced to put there. But I think what that text you just stated is kind of debunking that myth, right? It's actually how you control so people don't rise up in the prisons. They're revolutionary thoughts, so they're actually imprisoning ideas or people who have the revolutionary ideas. But what's the theme of the show is how prisons isolate, right? So maybe we could, if you could share a little bit more about that process of actually taking, and I know Schultz isn't the only one who has been imprisoned in these higher intensity control units for the revolutionary ideas that he has.
Right, and it gets deeper because some of you are wondering, right, if we're washing dishes or, you know, getting ready for tomorrow, for the start of the week, that, well, I could hear him, or I could hear Anita, or I could hear this show, but I can't really identify with, because I don't really know anyone being incarcerated. Well, here's the sad reality, that when we're talking about these control units, corporate America is thinking about how to create control units for our children. So these control units can be normalized in the schools. So you got some schools that are adopting, documenting these behavior modification units for little kids before it was written and all these drugs. Now they're actually creating spaces, physical spaces, to try this out. So what, in 10, 15, when very short coming, this is something normal. And that's the sad reality of that we face. And you raise a good point that when you create conditions that are torturous, but then you can introduce them and normalize them in our society, that to me is very, very scary. Because if you go to places like in East Oakland or even West Oakland, you look at some of these houses and how they're built and how they're looking, and they look like little cages. And that's been normal. That's been accepted by our neighbors, by our community, to be a normal happening. But now if you go to other places that have, like the hills of Oakland Hills, you don't see that. So it's very systemic, and it's done so refined. I think Maroon and others have spoken so good in their books that the level of oppression has been so refined by the powers that be that makes it difficult, if not impossible, to really talk about it and really garner a lot of attention. But stuff like these conditions inside, that many people are saying this can't happen anymore. Because if they allow this to happen and they make it normal, can you imagine what the future is going to look like? Well, you're not even going to have guards anymore, but robots controlling the lives of many people. And there's a lot of documentation that says that when you hold somebody for that long, it's torturing itself, because when you start to capture the mind, see, the body, you can lock it up. But if you have a resisting spirit, and you have this a spirit, that what I call the ancestral energia and espíritu, and that will to fight back, then it's hard to really capture the mind. And once the mind is captured, however, though, it's easier for anyone to control people. So I think for us is to make these connections. This is not just a conspiracy theory. This is not just left-wing extreme ideology. This is stuff that's happening right now on the auspices of a democratic society. But there's nothing democratic when folks who are the most impacted in society, whether it's working class immigrants who are working the fields to produce the food that we know that we be, that we're eating, as well as a lot of the products that are coming out of prisons that people don't recognize that they're wearing, like Victoria's Secret underwear, like some of the hardware that they see in public schools in different places.
And I think another, maybe Anita, you can speak to this in relation to how these tactics that are taking place within the prison, how they're actually affecting families, or in particular women, the work of women organizing outside the prisons, and also young people who are the next that are being targeted for.
Yeah. When Manuel was talking, I was thinking about my son being, when he first went away, they sent him up to High Desert, and he was put in, he was kept on lockdown. In fact, all the blacks were kept on lockdown, because that's what they do in California. If a Hispanic commits a crime, all the Hispanics are put on lockdown. All the blacks are put on lockdown. The only ones that are not all put on lockdown if they commit a crime are the whites. They don't put all the whites on lockdown. So my son was on lockdown. He never touched his son again after he was arrested. When we went to see him, we could only see him for an hour, and he was behind, you know, this window. And, you know, we could go, and it took us, like, all day to get there. So we spend the night, we see him for an hour, and leave. And during this time, he was put in, he was taken out of his cell and put in ADSEG, which is nothing but the SHU. It's administration segregation, because they were going to move him out of his cell. He was in a cell with someone he was getting along with, and he was like, well, why are you moving us? We're, you know, there's no problem or whatever. And the guards came in and dragged him out and put him in hold in ADSEG. And I asked him, I hadn't heard from him in like 2 months. I didn't hear from my son. And when I did hear from him, it was through his ex-roommate who had written, an ex-cellmate who wrote a letter and said, they have Kerry. I don't know where he is. They've taken him away. And so we went, you know, I called up there, and finally, he was, at that time point, he had been taken to the mental health, or the health, you know, he was in the medical ward. And they and the nurse, whoever it was I spoke to, I said, why didn't you people call me and tell me my son, you know, this, you know, he was here? Well, you're not listed as the next of kin. And I'm like, well, he's not married. Who else would be the next of kin? They, you know. And so I spoke to him, and he said, and he told me, he said, Mom, whatever they tell you, don't believe it. He said, I did not try to commit suicide. They said I was trying to commit suicide. He said, and he said, I've been in the cell, and he does not eat pork. And they were trying to feed him something that he thought was pork, and he couldn't see, you know, he said it was dark, and he refused to eat. So they said, he said they dragged him by the neck to the medical ward and told him he was trying to commit suicide. And so this is the way, this is what's going on. But he told me later, he said, Mom, you know what? I will, he said, I found my mind inside that place, inside that hole. He said, I touched a being, you know, this, I found my consciousness. And he said, nothing they do to me will hurt me from this point on, you know, because I found my consciousness. And, you know, that's like what Manuel was saying about, you find that that ancestor comes in, that spirit comes in, it either breaks you or makes you, whatever doesn't kill you will make you stronger. And so I, you know, I felt like he lifted me up when he was talking about it, you know, what happened and what he had gone through. And he said, you know what, I know I didn't do this thing, so I can sleep at night. You know, wherever they put me, I know I didn't do this thing. So he's comfortable with that. But the other thing is that with the whole, you know, prison, we're calling it the prison industrial complex, but I want to go back to this manifest destiny, which was what the Europeans said when they came to America. We are a part of their manifest destiny. Their manifest destiny comes at the expense of Native American lands and African slavery. So that's what they're doing. They're using us to manifest their destiny, to make their lives better and richer. And no matter what they do to us, we don't have a right to say anything. We don't have a right to complain. Who are we to complain? You know, this is about them. It's not about us. Even though they claim that, you know, to have given us, you know, this emancipation proclamation or whatever, we're still not free. We can't, you know, we're not allowed to say what we want to say, because we can be shot down. We can go to another country and be talking, and they can send somebody to shoot us down. I'm not saying this. This is what the government says. You know, so where is our freedom? You know, where is the freedom that, you know, supposedly protects us in the Constitution? It's not there. It does not exist. And the prison industrial complex is just part of it. And there's another person's name I want to bring up, Patty Hearst. This, what's going on now, is what Patty Hearst said when she turned into this, you know, when she became a part of the so-called SLA, or, you know, and she was out robbing banks and stuff, and she was saying that this is what they had in mind, to re-enslave the blacks. That's what they had in mind. The capitalist country, you know, this capitalist America, wants to, you know, take the land from the natives in Brazil. That's what they're doing right now. If you look at what She said her manifesto is happening right now. She was talking about the bankers. She was talking about what's going to happen because it's all about power and greed and manifest destiny. And we're not in it. We're not a part of it. You know, so.
So I guess I want to revisit that the question around community regeneration practices and what kind of work specifically are folks doing in your community that helps kind of build resiliency within the community.
So I wanted to go back and appreciate you raising that right now we're organizing around solitary confinement, or more importantly, around July 8th. Now, July 8th is going to be an important day in United States history for this reason. Some people may have heard of Bobby Sands, right, and the struggle of the IRA to be, of Ireland to be recognized by the British Empire as legitimate people and not slaves of the British throne. And Bobby Sands and about nine other comrades went on a hunger strike to protest their condition of confinement and to demand that they not only be freed, but the conditions of people in Ireland and to be recognized as, again, legitimate human beings. And that's the struggle that we got in Pelican Bay, in Cork, in Tehachapi, in Calipatria, all these places that they have security housing units. So there's some critical thinkers, some folks from inside that provided five ways to support this July 8th impending hunger strike. It might begin, and that can take on 30, 40, 50 days. The last two strikes that happened, I think the first one went for 21 days, the second one for 17. And the only reason they ended it because they wanted the CDCR, the California Department of Correction, a small R for rehabilitation, because that contradiction is more like retribution than rehabilitation, was because they, with good faith, wanted to see if CDCR was going to put what they said they would to end the hunger strike. But the five ways that they can support, because the people inside, these are people within the Corcoran shoe, they're saying that CDCR has taken some illegal steps to undermine the impact of the upcoming July 8th peaceful protest and completely control the narrative to the detriment of us all. That's their own words. And they say the number one is to demand compliance with the health regulations for hunger strikers. And what this means is that when the hunger strike actions begin, and weeks leading up to it all, they want us and folks who are involved to call Sacramento and each security housing unit that houses each prison, which are four, Pelican Bay, Corcoran, Tehachapi, and Calipatria, and demand that CCR staff comply with the California Correctional Healthcare Services Mass Hunger Strike Fasting and Refeeding Care Guide that was issued in September of 2012, and specifically as it relates to critical input data and diagnostic observation of hunger strike participants by nursing staff. This means that they want folks to weigh them, staff, to look at their blood pressure and body mass index. And what we've heard is that some of the staff have said, we're not going to do any of that when the hunger strike. So if they die, basically, oh well, it's not our fault. Mm-hmm. Number two, organize visiting team to the hunger strikers. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they want folks to come together, and we're part of a coalition that can offer support on that. So again, I'm going to reiterate the website to visit. Call the prison if you don't hear from a hunger strike correspondent. They say that if you do not hear from someone you're writing within 7 days of July 8th protest, call the prison immediately and repeatedly inquiring as to your correspondent's welfare and why his or her mail is being withheld. Number four, inundate legislative regular hunger strike updates. So flood them. Let them know what's going on. Because we have to understand that even though many of us believe that a lot of these legislators are being put in there by corporate corporations through their own lobbying efforts, was the CCPOA, the biggest, it was not a corporation, but it's still a strong union in California, one of the most strongest, that influenced public policies towards more retributive ways of dealing with in California, creating three-strike measures and whatnot. It's important for these legislators to not recognize what's really going on. And sometimes they turn a blind eye because they don't want to be perceived to be soft on crime and prohibit their bid in their career, you know, towards becoming the next senator, the next president, or governor of California. And then the last one is try to get mainstream news media coverage of the strike. And this is one of the most hardest ones. As someone who's an activist, many of us here are activists here in the room at the moment, because we don't control NBC, CBS, Fox, CNN. And then they control who, what stories and how they frame it. Even if they get one of us, if one of us flips it and says something that may not necessarily be aligned with what we're trying to push, they'll put that segment on TV to show the need for more jail, or to show that the worst of the worst are being held and we're advocating because they are demanding that we release them, which they've been using. So we have to understand that. And then the last thing they said, if nothing else, people can donate their time or their treasure to the Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity Coalition or the Stop the Torture campaign. And they said, this type of struggle is truly a battle for quote-unquote public opinion, another term for cultural hegemony. This type of social change, especially in the capitalist state repressive apparatus, what they call the prisons, where it has enjoyed virtual autonomy, is only going to succeed if social pressure is such that it's clear the culture and society is simply incompatible with this type of torture, and thus the torture must end. So they want us to start supporting them now, and there's many different ways. I named five, and again, Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity. It's a WordPress, so if people put that in on Google, they should be able to hit the website, and that's one other way they can contact me as well.
I'm involved in a pen pal project. We have a pen pal project to Occupy for Prisoners, where we're writing to the prisoners that are in the SHU and keeping them informed about what's going on out here, and they're telling us, you know, what's going on in there. I'm also involved in, I have a petition to have my son's, you know, conviction examined. My son, who went into prison in 2001, a healthy male, now has kidney disease. He's not being treated at the moment for his kidney disease. He's been exposed to TB. He doesn't, to his knowledge, have TB, but now he has to be x-rayed at least once a year. He has to get an x-ray. And he said that the person who had TB was left there in a general population. So if he has TB, there's other people there that also have TB, or they were exposed to TB. And so while Jerry Brown is trying to get the feds off of his back, these prisoners are suffering. You know, my son is suffering. He's 350 miles away. I have his 15-year-old son, who's my grandson, lives with me and has just reconnected with his father. And we just can't afford to go there and see him on a regular basis. So, and this is magnified 10,000 times with the amount of these young men who are being taken out of our community. And when I went to see my son at High Desert, it just amazed me, the young Hispanic males that were there, the young African-American males, they look barely teenagers, but they're in a state prison, you know? And that means that there's somebody, they're taking the soul out of our communities and locking them away, you know, for things that they will allow a white male to walk around. If he did that, he can still walk around, he can still retain his freedom. But we can't, because it's, you know, the system, nobody wants to say it out loud, but it's a racist, there's racism, and it's a sickness. Racism is a sickness. So I'm involved in, not only am I involved in organizations, I try to come out and support, you know, the organizations who are out here. You know, there's startup organizations, there's organizations that have been around a long time. And if they're marching or rallying and I can get there, then I come out and I support them. And a lot of us don't speak up. We know that it's wrong. We know that it's an injustice, but we don't want to say anything. And we need to get out and we need to speak up. We need to let our voices be heard. And if not, then we don't have a right to say anything. You know, we take our own power away by sitting silently and allowing this to continue.
Well, thank you, Anita and Manuel. Are there any other announcements that you would like to make in regards to any upcoming spaces or actions related to your work?
I forgot to mention, as I was wrapping up, that there's the author of a book called Out of Control, Nancy Kershon, will be available in San Francisco this upcoming Thursday at 518 Valencia. And she's talking about some of the stuff I was talking about. In fact, her work delves into what is solitary confinement, how these control units are being used in a society, and particularly, you know, the Marion control unit I quoted earlier. So the book is called Out of Control, A 15-Year Battle Against Control Unit Prisons. Again, Nancy Kirshen is the author. I'll be there. So if folks want to know more about what we're trying to do, raise awareness. One of the ways is, of course, getting on Radio Autonomía and just any other places, folks here that are available in Canada, Mexico, wherever we're being listened at the moment. Use your privileges. That's one of my, I tell this everywhere I go. Use your privilege, that being a male, that being educated, that having access to a DOD or someone that has a radio show. As little as it is or as huge as it is, try to figure out this. How do we raise at least a discussion that can speak about solitary confinement and about torture?
I have a book. I'm an author. I've written three books, and my third book is called Black Meek with the Life and Times of Henry Green, and it is about the incarceration of black males in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, prior to the Civil War. And the reason they were incarcerated is that there was a slave, you know, the Fugitive Slave Act was passed. And when this Fugitive Slave Act was passed, that meant that the southern slave owners could come into the north and run out and get their slaves. You know, before that, they didn't have the power. The north could say, no, we're not going to turn the slave over to you. So when the slave escaped to the north after the Fugitive Slave Act, they were allowed to come and get them. So they were coming and getting them and putting them into prisons. And my great-great-grandfather, Henry Green, and a bunch of other blacks who were free were going around freeing the slaves. As they were putting them in the jails, they would go around and free these slaves. And the slave owner approached Henry Green and a bunch of other free blacks in the community, and he wound up dead. And because of that, the Marines came in and they took over the town and they arrested, you know, the 38 black males. And they were charged with treason. They were put in prison, and they were tried in Philadelphia. And this was, the murder took place on 9/11/1851. Think about that date, 9/11/1851. That's when the murder took place. And the trial took place like a year or so later. And Thaddeus Stevens, who was in the movie Lincoln, he was their defense attorney. And he got them off. They all were able to walk free. And yet, this is not in the history books. But in my book, Black Maple, The Life and Times of Henry Green, I talk about that. And I talk about who my great-great-grandfather's heroes were, like Frederick Douglass, like these, you know, the abolitionists that were coming into town and talking about, you know, you need to take a stand. You need to help your brothers who are slaves. Just because you're free, you know, it doesn't mean you're off the hook. And, you know, the same thing I'm trying to say to the people in the community is that, you know, do something and help, you know, help other people. Don't look back and say, oh, he's not working. Isn't that sad? I'm working. No, what you do is you try to help that brother find a job, you know, because that's going to help you. That's going to help your community. And the other thing that I'm doing is I have a petition for my son. I have I'm helping my son, getting the story out about my son being wrongfully convicted. So he's on Facebook. It's we demand an investigation into the wrongful conviction of Kerry Baxter. So that's on Facebook, and if you go on the Facebook page, the petition is on the page, and we're asking people to sign the petition and to pass it on, and until we get enough signatures so that we can take it up and give it, you know, knock on Kamala Harris's door and present her with this petition. Thank you.
Great. Well, we'll have links to all these events and also the petitions and the information in regards to the actions. So thank you both for coming in and sharing your wisdom with us.
Thank you for having us.